Scenario number three, an employee was a real dog fan and had multiple pictures pinned up all around her cube of pictures of litters of puppies, not just a single puppy, but groups of puppies. And the hostile work environment complaint was that encourages commercial puppy mills. You should not allow that in the workplace. It creates a hostile work environment for me. Next scenario, multiple televisions in the gym. The TVs do not have volume. You have to plug your headphone into your machine thing and choose which channel you're going to watch. Some employees said that even just having Fox News on is offensive, even if I don't turn into it and listen. And it is creating a hostile work environment for me in my workplace because I want to go to the gym and I have to see Fox News. And the last one. The company has bathrooms. Yes, they have bathrooms. Some of them are labeled men, some of them are labeled women, and they have gender-neutral bathrooms. But the mere fact that they have some bathrooms that are reserved for men or reserved for women perpetuates the stereotype that gender is solely binary, and the fact that they exist creates a hostile work environment for me. So, this game time. Which one of these is fake? All of those of you who think it's the MAGA hat is fake, raise your hand. Nobody. All of those of you who think it's eating Chick-fil-A in the cafeteria was fake, didn't really happen, raise your hand. The puppies, if you think the puppies was fake, raise your hand. If you think the, which one am I up to? The Fox News in the gym was the fake, raise your hand. And finally, if you think the existence of bathrooms was the one that was fake, raise your hand. Well, most of you got it right. How can you say it's hostile or intimidating to see puppies? I mean, for gosh sakes, that one did not happen. But all the rest of these did in fact happen. Why did they happen and why did people feel encouraged to come forward and raise an issue of a hostile work environment based on those things? Well, it depends on what kind of policy you have. Most employers, I would go so far as to say, I think pretty much all employers now have a company policy against harassment. Everybody has known for a long time that you have to have one to establish the affirmative defense under Farragher and Ellerth to be able to show that you've taken appropriate steps to eradicate harassment. And more states, particularly on the heels of the Me Too movement, were adopting rules that said to avail yourself of that affirmative defense, your policy has to meet minimum requirements. It has to specifically prohibit sexual and other forms of harassment. It has to provide examples of what kind of behavior could constitute harassment, give people an avenue to report things that they find that are harassing, an investigation commitment by the company to investigate the allegations, to protect confidentiality, and to protect people from retaliation. Everybody has them, and it's a good thing, and I'm certainly not going to argue against an anti-harassment policy. But we all know what the law of sexual and other forms of harassment means. To create a hostile work environment, the behavior has to be sufficiently severe or so pervasive on both an objective and a subjective level to create a work environment that's hostile or intimidating. So really, if your employer says, you will never have a hostile work environment, they're not really promising you that much. They're just saying it won't be so miserable to be a living hell that you would say, oh, I can't work here, it's hostile and intimidating, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to be a great place to work. So some companies go a step further and have things that are alternatively called a civility code, or what we call it is a respectful workplace policy. And our policy begins with a statement of purpose, that employees should be able to come to work, focus on their jobs without the distractions and disruptions of things that employee finds offensive, inappropriate, or unprofessional in the workplace. In other words, it's not an objective standard, it's a very subjective standard. If you find it offensive or inappropriate, you shouldn't even have to deal with the distractions and the disruptions that causes in the workplace. The policy clearly goes beyond the law to prohibit all behavior that people find offensive. It's not limited to behavior that's directed at somebody because of their race, sex, color, national origin, disability, religion, etc. And it doesn't allow somebody to defend against their behavior by saying, well, what I did was not unlawful. I mean, no objective person would say that really creates a hostile work environment. We step in to take action even when it is very clearly not something that would be prohibited by the law. Sounds like a good deal, right? You have a workplace based on mutual respect. People treat each other, and it's a nicer place to work. What could possibly go wrong? Ah, that's where we get to the risks of a civility code. And you heard Rod and Jennifer talk about it earlier today, is the potential for a chilling effect on employees' Section 7 rights under the NLRA. Section 7 rights apply to all workplaces, irrespective of whether there's a union, and policies that would tend to chill employees' ability to express their discontent with management can run afoul of the NLRA. In your material, I've included some other examples from Dick Griffin's memo in 2015 that caused a huge uproar amongst a lot of employers, because some policy statements that we thought were apple pie and, you know, everything just wonderful were declared to be presumptively unlawful. Things like a policy that said, be respectful to the company, other employees, customers, partners, and competitors. Admonishing employees to be respectful was deemed to be a per se violation of the NLRA. Avoiding the use of offensive, derogatory, or prejudicial comments. I would imagine most of us have worked in a place that had a policy that said something similar to that.